For the week of August 7th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 201, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Sky Bar in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
What is the Sky Bar?
It's my sister's office.
Oh, okay.
That's what she calls it.
Okay, the Sky Bar? Because, you know, in Los Angeles, there is a Sky Bar that is at the Mondrian Hotel, and it's kind of a well-known...
I've been there. I stayed at the Mondrian when I went there for a film preview.
Oh, really? What film was it?
Sleazy Press Junket. I was a college student. It was not Good Morning Vietnam. That was San Francisco. It was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Okay, so since then, since that time, the late
80s... You too was staying at the Mondrian at the same time.
Yeah, now they probably stay at the Chateau Marmont right down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't actually stay in a hotel. They probably rent a villa somewhere.
Yeah. Well, they were pretty big then.
Yeah.
They weren't exactly up and coming.
Yeah, it was 1987. And
yeah.
That was
the year, the Joshua Tree.
That's right. And they then, they've not you too, but the hotel has kind of refurbished itself and has this big bar that all the big hoity-toity people
Yeah, but my sister's Sky Bar has baseball caps.
Oh. Okay, what kind of baseball caps?
The ones that say Sky Bar on it.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I don't think that the Sky Bar in Los Angeles, where the likes of Lindsay Lohan hangs out, they probably don't have baseball caps.
But do they know what we're going to talk about this week on the show?
I think they probably do, because, you know, what is everybody else talking about? Everybody else is talking about what we're going to talk about on today's show, which is really just tracking the summer's so-so box office. And, you know, Johnny Depp and Jerry Bruckheimer, you might recall them from, you know, The Lone Ranger. They made that little movie, The Lone Ranger, with Gore Verbinski and Armie Hammer. Well, they have a familiar idea regarding who to blame for The Lone Ranger's failure. Hint? It isn't them. Time Warner Cable and CBS, they continue their standoff over carriage fees. Everybody's talking about that. The cable provider has already blocked out all CBS networks, and the dispute is getting pretty ugly and has always been public.
Did you say carriage?
Carriage fees, yes.
It's not carriage?
It's not carriage fees. No, they've moved on to automobiles.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, about these and maybe it's instead of carriage, we should say retransmission fees. But whatever you call them, Wall Street analysts are saying, get used to it. Carriage disputes or retransmission disputes, they're the new normal when it comes to television. Meanwhile, it looks like Sony won't be abandoning its entertainment divisions anytime soon, despite the public protests of an activist investor. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We'll be looking at the box office around the world. The number one movie in the entire world this week is Smurfs 2. It made $44 million. It's at $156 million and counting. It's open pretty wide. It's in 66 territories. That's most of the world. So we'll have to see where it ends up. It obviously did very poorly in North America. We'll see if it makes it up overseas.
I know where it ends up. It ends up in Smurfs 3.
At number two around the world is Elysium. The Neil Blomkamp, I don't know how to say that.
Blomkamp.
His film from the director of District 9 and starring Matt Damon. How do you say it?
Blomkamp.
Blomkamp. All right. That grossed $41 million around the world. It made $30 million in North America and another $11 million overseas. And number three around the world is Pacific Rim, the Peter Jackson film. Peter Jackson. The Guillermo del Toro film. He backed out of The Hobbit in order to make this. And Peter Jackson stepped in to make The Hobbit. They both make big movies. This is Pacific Rim. It's not doing great. It's at $344 million worldwide and counting. It's more than doubled its domestic budget. It's still struggling to get to $100 million in North America. Not quite there yet. It's at $97 million and counting. And number four around the world, the big success story in North America this week is We're the Millers, a sort of raucous comedy a la the Hangover movies.
Yes.
This is about people smuggling drugs in from Mexico into North America. It's hilarious. Jennifer Aniston's a stripper. Who doesn't want to see that? It grossed $26 million over the weekend. But since Wednesday when it opened, it's made $38 million. That's basically the movie's budget. So everybody's happy on this one. At number five around the world, The Wolverine, the Hugh Jackman film about the Avengers character. $26 million worldwide. The X-Men character. $26 million worldwide. It's at $308 million and counting.
So is this a success? I mean, can we say, hey, The Wolverine is a success? Yeah, I didn't think so.
Not yet. It's just at $300 million. It cost about 120 million to make and a lot to market. So it's right about on the edge. It's certainly not going to lose money for anyone. We'll have to see how much more money it pulls in if it gets closer.
But how sad is that you've made a product where you make three times the amount that it cost nearly three times the amount that it cost to manufacture the product, okay? And you earn $308 million and it's still like, well, it's you know, on the bubble.
Well, it's a big summer movie and had a big budget for prints and advertising.
Yeah.
And it's made more of its money overseas, where, of course, the studios get a little bit less back than they do in North America, though that's improving all the time. So all those factors mean, hey, it's not a flop. It's going to be all right. And if it can keep chugging along and get to $400 million, then it'll be a solid success story. At number six around the world, a movie that will not be a success story is Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters. This is the second film in a series, a would-be franchise, based on books by Rick Riordan. Teenage boys know the books well. It grossed $24 million over the weekend and $34 million since it opened up in worldwide. Most of that's a little bit of it came overseas. I'm confused by the numbers here.
$10 million overseas, $24 million domestically.
That $24 million domestic is for the 5 days since it opened. That's
correct.
Right.
Yes.
It only made $14 million over the weekend. Basically, it opened well below what the first one opened at, and that's not a good sign. It cost $90 million to make. This movie, like a lot of other movies, made a lot more money overseas, and that's why they made a sequel, even though it wasn't exactly a home run. I like the kid who stars in it, Logan Lerman. He's a talented actor. It did cost $90 million to make. Got pretty poor reviews. It'll have to be rescued by worldwide box office, but it's off to a sort of start. $34 million worldwide and counting.
I have to admit, I didn't even know this movie opened.
Well, you have a little girl. Your little boy, too, right?
No, two little girls.
Two little girls, that's why you don't know. If they were a little older, they might like Logan Lerman. And number seven is Planes, the film from Disney Toons, which is the straight-to-DVD division of Disney. It was made to go straight to DVD, but then they disliked how much it turned out, so they decided to release it in theaters. It's not technically a Pixar film, but it is a spinoff from the Cars franchise. Planes grossed $22 million since it opened, I think, on Wednesday in North America alone. When it opened up, Hollywood Reporter had the stupidest comment. It started off really strongly, especially daytime grosses. And they said, will Planes break the animation curse?
Yeah, I couldn't believe they were saying that. I thought, you know, just because Jeffrey Katzenberg said that a week ago, that there was a glut of family-oriented animated films in the market, doesn't mean you have to somehow spin it to try. I mean, it just, I couldn't agree with you.
Curse is just
more
stupid. Like, as if for 20 years now, people have made animated films and they've all been done poorly, or nobody can make a baseball film, or no one can make a live musical. It's like, give me a break. And what annoys me about it is not like you have to go back and search your memory to remember when there was an animated film that was a hit. The two biggest films in release right now are Despicable Me 2 and Monsters University. They're the biggest hits in the entire world right now. They're playing in theaters right now. How is that a curse? It's just extremely annoying. It's just lazy. They're trying to get people to click on it and jazz up a story about the fact that Planes opened decently. And then what happened was it fell off quite a bit and it didn't do as well as they thought. But it only cost $50 million to make. It's made $22 million so far, and that's just in North America. And of course, if it's like Cars, the kids will buy a million toys and they'll make a lot of money there.
You know, it's funny that you say that they put this movie in theaters kind of at the last minute, or they decided to put it in theaters.
Just like Toy Story 2.
Yeah,
that's going to go straight to DVD as well.
I have to say that, you know, for as long as I can remember going to all these conventions and where you have studios pitching, upcoming movies to movie theater owners, they've been pitching Planes at least 3 years ago, it seems like, that they were saying, oh, Planes is coming. We're making a Planes movie.
Well, but at first they were talking about it as a straight-to-DVD product, I thought.
No, not to these movie theater owners. What are the movie theater owners?
Yeah, well, then maybe that's to them trying to downplay expectations or say, you know, hey, we made a cheapo movie, but we want to pretend it's, you know, actually a success story even before it comes out.
Yeah, maybe.
So that's just marketing. At number eight, one of those cursed animated films, Despicable Me 2, it made $18 million. It's at $745 million worldwide and counting. That's cursed like a lottery winner. At number nine around the world is The Conjuring, the horror film that's done a great job. It's made $16 million worldwide this weekend. It's at $168 million and counting. It cost about $12 to make, so everybody's thrilled.
Why do you say 10, that? You know it costs $14 and 50 cents.
At number 10, we have a movie we can talk about a little bit, The Lone Ranger. It made $14 million around the world. It's basically done in North America. So that's basically all internationally. It's struggling to get to $200 million worldwide. It's at $196 million and counting. It's in 54 markets right now. I'm not sure what big markets it has left. It has some. I think they said it's only open in 40% of the world. Well, that can't be right with 54 markets, but they claim there's some big markets left to come. But what did they say about The Lone Ranger? Johnny Depp and Jerry Bruckheimer weighed in on this film.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they're opening it up in the UK and Ireland, and they did an interview with Yahoo, and in it, the journalist was quite smart in approaching it and said, hey, you know, we think the reviews, the critics in America maybe killed this. And Johnny Depp said, I think the reviews were probably written when they heard that Gore and Jerry and I were going to do The Lone Ranger. And he went on to say, I think that Gore made a very brave film.
And what did Jerry Bruckheimer say?
Jerry Bruckheimer, I mean, you know, Armie Hammer said the same thing, too, that he said, you know.
That's what people always say when a movie gets dissed. Oh, the critics were headed out for us.
Right. That basically it was the reviews were written after the film fell apart the first time. Jerry Bruckheimer went on and he said, I think they were reviewing the budget, not the movie.
That's the other complaint people always make. Ah, why are they mentioning the budget? It doesn't matter to moviegoers. They just want to see a good movie. Why do you care how much we spend? Unless, of course, they spend a lot and they want you to know it costs a lot, so it feels like a big event movie.
Right. Well, what I love is he goes on to say, the critics keep crying for original movies. You make one, and they don't like it.
The Lone Ranger is not an original movie.
I know.
It could have been a good movie, and I liked it more than most people. I'm one of the rare people who saw it and thought, hey, I kind of enjoyed myself. It was a Western. I liked what they did. There was a lot about it I liked. I thought Depp's performance was actually pretty restrained. It was more on target than he's been in his last few movies. And I don't know what I'll think about it a second time. I'll be interested to see how I feel when I see it. I might watch it on DVD and go, ooh, what was I thinking? But I was just in the mood for a Western. I went with the tone. I thought it was fairly consistent. I liked the fun thing that they did at the end with the big action set piece. And the little weird, dumb stuff, like this rabid rabbit, I just ignored that. The really bad little jokes off in the corner. I just pretended they didn't happen. So, you know, there you go. I'm not on their side. It wasn't the budget. It wasn't the critics. It was the movie they made that audiences just stayed away from the get-go. Critics can slam a movie and it can make a ton of money. Critics can slam a movie and it can flop. They rarely affect big films. As Roger Ebert said, the late Roger Ebert, now we have to say that, he said where he felt like he and Siskel could have an effect was in the smaller movies, on the margins. There was a small film, they could bring some attention to it. If there was a film with really good reviews, they could get people to go who maybe wouldn't go already. Right. Or it's a crowd pleaser and they could say, hey, you know, they could bring attention to a smaller film and help it out. They couldn't really stop people from seeing a small film, even if they didn't like it. They couldn't stop people from seeing a big film, but they could sometimes give a leg up to something that would benefit from that extra little bit of exposure. But of course, Disney was exposed a lot on The Lone Ranger, weren't they?
Yeah, to the tune of $190 million, according to the, I guess, who was it? The CFO, Jay Rusolo, says, you know, we're going to probably write down $160 to $190 million dollars in the next quarter. We don't know because we still have 40% of the markets to open in. And by 40%, we mean, I don't know where.
I don't know where he got that number because that doesn't make sense. But with friends like Mark Wahlberg, who needs enemies?
Yeah, well, Mark Wahlberg, I guess, was also asked about, entertainment journalism in general, but he was talking about The Lone Ranger. And he said, first and foremost, the media is targeting all these.
Well, he was talking about the summer movies in general that were sort of collapsing. You know, there was a couple movies in a row, like Pacific Rim, which has done okay. And The Lone Ranger and a few other big movies like the Will Smith that didn't do well. And there was sort of, I think, in the context, not so much of The Lone Ranger, but all these movies and how they were sort of not delivering.
Right. And he says, there's intense scrutiny on us, way more than before. They are spending so much money to pull the wool over the audience's eyes with these effects-driven movies. It's not like Jurassic Park, where you saw something groundbreaking and innovative and said, holy, insert expletive, I gotta see that. Every end of the earth movie kind of feels the same.
What I love is he's saying this in the context of his next movie, which is Transformers.
Right. He says Transformers is a different thing. What Michael's been able to do is elevate the material and take the human element to a whole other place so that when the world ends, there's huge explosion. No, he doesn't say that last part. Having the father-daughter relationship is so much more interesting.
This is Mark Wahlberg talking about director Michael Bay and the humanistic element he's going to bring to the Transformers films.
Yes, well, but then he goes on to say, and this is probably the best quote. He says, they're spending $250 million for two dudes on a horse. Where's the money going? And he was talking about the Lone Ranger.
Right. So he said, oh, I feel bad for these movies. They're being targeted because they make so much money. We're under so much scrutiny. But a lot of them are just dumb special effects that just ignore the fact they haven't made a good movie. And why did the Lone Ranger cost so much anyway? Well, thanks, Mark. I guess you won't be going over to Johnny's house anytime soon for dinner.
No, probably not. But that probably wasn't going to happen anyway.
That was The Lone Ranger at number 11, a film that was a success story and an unusual one, is Now You See Me, which is the film about illusionists who rob banks to give the money to the poor or something like that. It made $13 million worldwide. It's at $255 million and counting. It's more than tripled its $75 million budget. It's so successful. Yes, they're going to make a sequel. I assume it will be called Now You Don't.
Oh, that would... You know what? Hold on. Get Michael Linton on the phone. Where's Amy Pascal?
Well, it will probably be Now You See Me Too, but I think Now You Don't will be cleverer.
Yes.
At number 12,
although,
around the world.
Although cleverer is not a word, so you might not want to.
At number 12 around the world is Snowpiercer. That's the South Korean film, but it's an English language movie starring Jamie Bell, one of my favorite actors. It grossed another $13 million. It's at $34 million and counting. It's doing gangbusters in South Korea. We'll be talking to it again soon later in the show. And number 13 is Two Guns, the Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington film, another $11 million. It's at about $50 million and counting. And number 14, the Adam Sandler film, Grown Ups 2. That's $150 million worldwide. At number 15, Old People Can Kick Butt. That's the movie Red 2. That's struggling to get to $100 million worldwide. It made another $10 million overseas. At number 16, one of those cursed animated films, Monsters University. It's at $637 million worldwide. Cursed like Rupert Murdoch. At number 17, World War Z, the Brad Pitt film, that made another $8 million, and it has now passed the $500 million mark, making it the most successful Brad Pitt film of all time, domestically, internationally, and worldwide, and that does include the Ocean's movies.
You know, you have to wonder if you're working for Paramount, and you're an executive there, and your Brad Pitt zombie movie surpasses the $250 million budget mark. You've got to be looking at his track record going, oh boy, I'm in trouble. Because there's no way we're making $500 million on this. He's never made $500 million before. Well, he almost did with Troy back in 2004. So that was 9 years ago at the height of his, I guess he's still pretty much a big celebrity. But
he's had his biggest hit of all time. That's how you judge it. Mr. and Mrs. Smith made $478 million. The Ocean's 11 made $450 million. Troy made $497 million. It just missed half a billion. So this movie is his biggest hit so far in his entire career, including movies jam-packed with celebrities like the Ocean's films. So big success for Brad Pitt, but because the movie costs so much, it's just barely getting into the black.
Right, but you know, the problem with Ocean's 11 and all those Ocean's movies, and the reason they didn't do so well, no zombies.
That's right. At number, I think right below World War Z, right around the same price, well, there's a movie called The Terror Live, which we talked about, that made another $8 million. That's at $20 million and counting. But right in the mix here, I believe, is a Bollywood film called Chennai Express. Forgive me if I'm saying it wrong. It's a Bollywood action comedy, very high profile movie. It opened around in a lot of the world at the same time. And from what I can gather, it seems to have made about $8 million worldwide. It looks like it made $5 million in India. I should say that region. I'm not quite sure about just India. But that includes some record-setting box office numbers. It made about $2 million in the U.S. alone from 200 screens. It opened up in the U.K. and some other territories. And it opened in some countries like Peru, day and date. So this is a big movie with high-profile stars. It's an action comedy. It got mixed reviews, but it looks like it made about $8 million. It was not on our Rentrak listing. But when I spotted the movie in some other areas and then pieced together all the different stories I could find, that's where it looks like it made up money. You don't get good tracking on Bollywood films because those companies are in their own world and they're not really focused on us and the rest of the world. They're just starting to promote their movies to us and try and open them. I mean, look at that. It opened in America and made $2 million.
And
that's,
I should say, when it makes $2 million on 200
screens.
Yeah, and it's not playing a majority of those screens. There's like a whole Indian film circuit, which is,
of course, yeah,
kind of not widely known about in certain
pockets.
Well,
it is
pockets.
If you're Indian.
Yes, correct. But they only play like one or two shows on a Sunday. So for it to make $2 million in the U.S. with that kind of run, that's amazing.
Well, but that, it's playing in Manhattan. I mean, it's not just. I mean, there is a neighborhood in Queens with a theater that shows all Bollywood films, but it's playing in multiplexes in Manhattan, so it's not that obscure. And I think you see that a little bit more and more. And when it makes 11,000 per screen and it's doing that well, it's going to continue. So they're just starting to reach out to the rest of the world. The more they do, the more success they'll have, because they can be fun movies just like any other movie. You know, they don't have to be 4 hours with musical interludes. They can they can be all types of movies, and they're really reaching out and making an effort. But so that's there. And then below that we have The Heat, Melissa McCarthy, that's just about to hit $200 million worldwide. Turbo, if we're going to talk about the curse of animated films that Jeffrey Katzenberg talked about.
Wow.
Turbo made another $5 million worldwide. It's at $137 million worldwide and counting. And yet he convinces us when he's speaking to analysts, oh, of course it'll make a profit. Well, we'll have to see.
Well, that's because he believes that it will do well in China, where he thinks it will be opening. And, you know, you can never tell whether a movie is going to open in China. Last week we talked about Despicable Me 2 and how the Chinese government or the China Film Group and SARFT wasn't going to let it in. And the Chinese contacted us, all of them. We've been answering the phone all week. And they said, hey, you know what? Actually, that we didn't ban it. Okay. We're very upset for you for saying so.
The reasons are silly.
Yes. And you know, it has nothing to do with the fact that the little minions, those little yellow pill things, look like our president, or that we, you know, it's been said that, or that we're trying to promote our homegrown animation. It's that they never submitted it for review, so it can't be released. At least that's what SARFT and the China Films. Well, no, SARFT is saying that.
Which is malarkey.
Yeah, I would agree.
They never asked to be released in China, so therefore it wasn't rejected. So they're not banning it, they're just not showing it.
Right.
In final news and box office, if we haven't confused you enough, probably the biggest news in limited release is Blue Jasmine, which did even better than Chennai Express. The Woody Allen film made another $2.5 million. It's only on 116 screens. It made $21,000 per screen. It's just tearing it up. It's made $6 million so far. And this sucker looks like it's going to be his biggest hit since Midnight in Paris, which was just a minute ago. But it looks like it could become one of his biggest hits ever. If this keeps up, I'm not quite sure why. But more power to Woody.
But he's done a film a year for how many years now? 40-something years? That's pretty good.
Well, it would be better if they were good. For the last 20 years, he's made a lot of bad movies every year, but that's okay.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of people who are doing pretty well, Jay Leno. I had to go pick somebody up at the Burbank Airport, or Bob Hope, as it's called now. And just getting to the airport last, I want to say it was Wednesday, or maybe it was Tuesday. It was Tuesday. And I guess Obama was in town going to the Tonight Show, and not as a you know, audience member. He was the guest of honor. I could not get to the airport because of all the, you know, hubbub.
When the president comes to town, traffic jam happens. But the more important thing is that the president comes on the Tonight Show and the ratings happen.
That's right. So Jay Leno, you know, we've talked a lot about Jay Leno. So if you haven't been following our show, guess what? He's doing incredibly well, so he's fired. You know, he's on again, off again, Tonight Show host, and he took over for Conan after they kind of sacked Conan.
We don't have to go over the history. They all know. Yeah. Everybody knows about Jay Leno. The fact is that the NBC says, yes, Jay Leno's ratings are terrific. They've really gone up. He's beating by Letterman. He's beating Jimmy Kimmel. He's beating people by large margins. He's doing great in the 18 to 34 demo. He's tearing it up. And they say, well, that's what happens when you announce you're leaving. That's
again,
what happened with Johnny. That's what happened the last time we fired Jay Leno. And that's what's happening this time. And so we're not freaked out. We're not saying we made a mistake. We expected this to happen. And now we've got an official date when Jay Leno will be saying goodbye.
February 6th.
That's right. Right before the Winter Olympics begin will be the last goodbye for Jay Leno. And then the Monday after the Olympics end, they end with the closing ceremonies on Sunday, February 23rd of next year. That following Monday is when will be the debut of Late Night with...
No, the Tonight Show.
The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, followed by the debut of the Late Night with Seth Meyers. So Jimmy Fallon will step in for Jay. Seth Meyers will step in for Jimmy Fallon as the show following the Tonight Show, and it's all locked in, and we have no regrets. We have no second guessing, none at all. It doesn't matter how well he's doing, which is very, very well.
Right. It's just, I mean, I know that you believe this is a huge mistake.
I don't like Jimmy Fallon, so I think he's just a boring host and a terrible interviewer. He's a nice guy, seems to be. Everybody loves him. Everybody goes on his show. I think the panic over Jimmy Kimmel coming to 11:30, who's done a lot better than I thought, because I think he's just terrible as well. I think they're both just horrifically bad talk show hosts. They are absolutely awful. Jimmy Kimmel in particular is hilariously unfunny, capped with the fact that he can't do an interview. So it's my idea of a nightmare. I'll take Letterman and Craig Ferguson from now till doomsday compared to those guys.
Craig Ferguson is hilarious.
Craig Ferguson is great. And we've got Jay Leno leaving. I'm not a huge fan of Jay Leno, but he can be a decent interviewer sometimes. But, you know, he's got the audience. He's number one. He's been number one every time he's been on there. Why would you kick someone off when he's number one? He could go another decade and not blink an eye. So why you'd want to get rid of him? Because you're worried about, oh, you got to get the 18, 30, you know, people buy stuff when they're 50. CBS is making the argument again and again. You know, advertisers have to get off this idea that 17-year-olds and 35-year-olds and 50-year-olds don't matter because they only want these slivers of demos. If people are watching TV, they're probably healthy enough to buy a product. So, you know, stop worrying about those demos. And if you just looked at total audience, you'd be crazy to get rid of Jay Leno. NBC says they're not getting rid of him. They're saying, you know what? We want him to do primetime specials like Bob Hope. We have a great relationship. He loves us. We love him. Yeah, right. But they do want him to do primetime specials, not a primetime weekly show. But they want him to come back 3-4 times a year, do a Bob Hope type thing. And hey, you know what? That could work. Everybody could be a winner. Jay could go in primetime and come on 4 times a year, have a big variety show, have a big success, then tour the country like he does, and maybe Jimmy Fallon will flourish in the new time period. If I was in charge, I wouldn't do it. Of course, if I was in charge, I would have given it to David Letterman in the first place.
Ooh, that's true. Now, Dave Letterman is over on CBS where nobody can see him right now. At least,
well,
you know,
nobody in New York and LA. There is the rest of America.
Dallas.
Oh, okay, right. But I'm saying there's a lot, most of the country, 70% of the country can see them, which is why this standoff isn't really having much of an effect. CBS is going big deal because their ratings have not dropped. CBS and Time Warner Cable are in this big dispute. And Time Warner Cable says, we're yanking your broadcast from New York and LA and Dallas. And the ratings have not been affected at all for Big Brother, for Under the Dome, for all these CBS shows that are airing right now. And they're either going to have to wait until fall when new shows begin to try and scare CBS, or they're going to have to blink now and say, well, this is not really, you know, threatening you. So we're going to have to act or wait 3 months to do it.
Yeah, I guess the New York Times 31 minutes ago, in fact, they said, you know, blacked out in three cities, CBS still wins ratings race. That's the headline in the New York Times.
So I mean, what's going to happen? So Time Warner Cable made this offer. They said, hey, they apparently listened to Showbiz Inbox. They said, why don't you just become a cable channel? Then you can charge people what you want.
Right.
And CBS said, oh, you're not making a serious offer. You're trying to rebroadcast our shows digitally. Meaning, you know, if you pay for cable, then Time Warner Cable says, hey, we want to be able to let people watch their channels on their tablets or their iPad or their phone, wherever they go. And CBS said, oh, you're just trying to, you know, gain a whole new business and we don't care about you and blah, blah, blah. And this isn't a serious offer. But the fact is, if they did go as a cable channel, what could they charge? $1, $1.50? It's another $100 million for homes, right?
Yeah, they'd probably be easily get away with $2, definitely. And, you know, so I guess ahead of time, Warner.
And how much would that be? That'd be $2 a month?
Yes, $2 per subscriber per month.
Well, say it's a dollar.
Which is what they're asking for right now, by the way.
Oh, okay. So say if they got $2, well, that's $80 million. Well, no, that's like $150 million a month, probably. 75 million homes
that's
for cable
right.
bills. So that'd be $150 million a month. I mean, what are they getting? I mean, what are they losing if they do this? I know Time Warner Cable wasn't serious, but what would they be risking if they went as a cable channel? That nobody would want to pay for CBS?
That's I have no idea.
Feasible. All right.
No, yeah, you know, we should get somebody on here who could explain exactly what they would be losing. I'll look into getting a guest who can explain that.
Well, the ratings are not falling, but in fact, we've also seen piracy rates shoot up. It looks like people who are watching Time Warner Cable in New York, LA, and Dallas, who cannot get access to their shows, are turning to piracy. They're going to the pirate sites, and those rates are shooting up.
For Under the Dome CBS and Big Brother.
Yeah, Under the Dome, Big Brother. Things like that. People are going and stealing. Of course, there's always the risk. Once they get used to that, they never go back. But, you know, hey, so that's interesting. But that's not going to affect the ratings. And basically, the ratings have held steady. 3 million homes cannot access CBS right now. But overall, the ratings have remained steady. So money-wise and advertising-wise, CBS doesn't have any reason to start blinking. And that's why you think this will continue until the fall season, right, Sperling?
I think it's going to probably continue until fall and or football starts. And then they'll really get, you know, after everybody gets back from their summer vacation, and by everybody, I mean the executives at Time Warner and the executives at CBS, they'll sit down and they'll hammer something out. And I just don't see how Time Warner can win this one, despite the fact that I would publicly side with Time Warner. I mean, there is a
cable.
You're absolutely right. Time Warner Cable. That's right. Before we get letters, you're absolutely right. Time Warner. I don't see how Time Warner Cable could win this.
Until then, or even if after they do?
Even in the fall, I don't see how they win this. They're basically, if they want to carry that channel, they're, or that network and its programming, they will have to pay whatever CBS wants. And that's part of the problem with the 1992 legislation that Congress has enacted. And I realize that for a lot of people who are outside the country, this seems like a whole bunch of gibberish and doesn't...
Well, the government's involved in the state broadcast and all that, so it's an issue that people face all over the world.
Right. But there's some old legislation on the books, and, you know, that's what's causing this whole kerfuffle.
Well, but Time Warner Cable has to carry CBS, whether there's a government law or not.
That's right.
Believe me, the outcry may be minimal now, but when I call Time Warner Cable for another reason, the very first thing they say is, if you're wondering why we don't have CBS, press one. And that is going to become a deafening roar come fall.
That's right.
Football, I don't care why you guys are fighting. I'm paying you $80, $100 a month. I want my CBS. You make it happen. And that's what Time Warner Cable is going to be facing. So if anything, the pressure is on them to get a good deal, as good a deal done as they can now, because the pressure on them is going to increase come the fall, not CBS.
Well, a couple of points here. Let's talk about piracy for just a second, or not even talk about it. My only comment here is piracy rates shoot up when people can't
get legal access.
Right. If you make access difficult and or overly priced, then piracy goes up, as you can see from this example. That's exactly what, in my opinion.
And HBO. You know, if you have to wait 3 months to see it in Australia, then you're not going to wait. You're going to pirate it. When we have to wait, PBS has just decided and announced we are not going to move up the premiere date of Downton Abbey. We like that it's in January. We like that there's less pressure on the new fall season for them to compete against. And so even though it starts in the fall in the UK, we're going to wait till January, whenever the date is, before we start the new season of Downton Abbey in America. Please just avoid spoilers. But the fact is, well, if we have to wait 3 or 4 months, people are just going to step in and get it any way they can.
That's exactly what will happen. And that's what will happen when you have something like this CBS Time Warner Cable dispute. Now, the other thing is, it's being fought in public, this whole battle. And so Time Warner Cable sends a letter to CBS and Leslie Moonves. Leslie Moonves sends a kind of scathing letter back, but he publishes it, so the press has it. I love the fact, though, that he
well, they know anything they send is going to be public.
Right. I like the fact he points out, and this is Leslie Moonves, the head of CBS, pointing out to Time Warner Cable, you know, instead, your subscribers in Los Angeles are already being charged in the neighborhood of $4 for the Lakers, and likely more than that for the Dodgers, both of which you have pulled off broadcast television entirely, meaning the games of those two teams.
Right.
These charges are added to the cost of your customers' basic monthly bill, whether they want them or not. And guess who owns the networks for the Lakers and the Dodgers? That's right, Time Warner Cable. So he's kind of like really just jiving them, you know, he's going to their Achilles heel.
But he's asking them to do the same thing for CBS. He's saying, we want you to charge your subscribers $2 for CBS, whether they want it or not. Maybe people don't want CBS. Maybe not everybody wants to watch Criminal Minds and CSI. And NCIS LA.
That's right. No, right. I couldn't agree. Yes,
which
I
is why their offer of, hey, why don't you go a la carte, is not so ridiculous.
Right. Now, of course, you know, Les Moonves and the head of Time Warner Cable, they're saying, look, we ain't going a la carte. So it's not happening anytime soon. Chase Carey says, well, it might have to. Chase Carey's the head of Fox. It might have to someday, is what he says. But what's even more interesting about this whole case is digital rights, because really what CBS is saying is, we'd like to charge you $2 per month, and oh, by the way, we're not going to allow you to have the digital rights anymore the way we used to.
And what do you mean by digital rights?
The ability to stream shows and programming over the internet.
Well, people have never done that. Time Warner Cable's never done that. They barely let you watch it on a tablet in your home. That's the most they offer right now. So it's not anything they're taking away from their customers.
Well, Time Warner Cable allows you to, you know, watch it on the go on your tablet. Now, that's...
In your home.
No, I can do it on the go. Not everybody has that yet.
No, I don't have that.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's available in New York. In LA, they finally rolled it out where you can do that.
Which is ridiculous that CBS won't let them do that.
Right. And so,
because you're paying $100 a month for cable, CBS wants $2 a subscriber, or rather cable home, and yet they don't want it to make it easier for you to watch their show. They want you to make you go to the CBS.com or let them sell it to some other company so they can sell it to you as well, like Netflix, you know.
Well, what Les Moonves, the head of CBS, says is, what you are asking for, pure and simple, is either to gain the right to deliver content for free that others are paying for, or to inhibit CBS from licensing content to existing online competitors and new companies that are now emerging. I can understand why you might want to preserve your dominance in that venue, but bullying us into becoming your accomplice in that effort doesn't seem fair. Well, you know what?
Give me a break. So they want to double dip. They want to charge you for watching the show, and then they want to charge you if you want to watch the show on the go, and they want to charge you if you want to watch the show. And then, if they could, they charge you for DVRing the show. It's like, no. This is you're paying a lot of money for monthly access to the television. This is a reasonable extension of what that is. It's not dipping into anything. It's not dipping into your syndication. It's not dipping into whatever. It's just like the show's on the air and you want to be able to watch it within the next 5-7 days. You should be able to do it with all the new technology that's out. And they're being very short-sighted in not making that part of the deal.
But what CBS is saying here is, we're not going to give you that right, Time Warner Cable.
Right, and they're wrong.
We're going to be able to, because if we do, then when we go to Netflix or Hulu, they're going to say, is this exclusive? And when we say...
No, that's got nothing to do with Netflix. It doesn't interfere with Netflix.
Well,
it's like saying DVRs interfere with Netflix. Netflix is once the season is over or whatever, or days later, or Hulu. That's got nothing to do with whether you can watch a channel on CBS on your iPad when you have cable subscription.
Well, that's CBS is selling their stuff to Hulu and Netflix. So they're basically taking that content, the content that they're not allowing Time Warner to have, and then reselling it to Netflix and Hulu. And that's exactly
right, they don't have to stop your DVR in order to do that.
Oh, we're not talking about DVR
yes,
here.
Yes, we are. If you're telling me that I can't take my tablet and watch a show when it's on the air, or watch it on the DVR via your tablet or whatever, the next day or whatever, which anybody can do, I can watch it a week later on my DVR. That does not interfere with Hulu or Netflix at all.
Correct.
And the fact that I can't do that on my tablet, I have to be actually physically in my home, is antiquated backwards thinking. It's ridiculous. It is not an interference. It's a service that is a reasonable extension of what they already do. And there's people who don't have cable or whatever, and they want to watch it on Hulu or they want to watch it on Netflix. That's fine, too. But they don't interfere with each other. There's no conflict. And that's ridiculous.
Well, Time Warner Cable would say, actually, it is a bit of a conflict, because if you could get CBS programming at Netflix, you might cancel your cable subscription.
That's true.
And so what they're saying is, you're giving us a product.
I'm saying that they should allow Time Warner Cable to have, you know, TV to go.
Right.
And that Time Warner Cable should not try and pretend somehow that they can stop them from selling it to Netflix as well.
Correct. Because if everybody has it, then it's a matter of service as opposed to product. And what Craig Moffett, an analyst, he's a well-known analyst on Wall Street, he says the big takeaway here about this whole Time Warner Cable and CBS conflict, he says the big takeaway here is that Netflix has won. Like crack dealers, they have succeeded in getting CBS hooked on the incremental revenues of digital distribution. So Netflix comes along, says here's a couple extra dollars for the rights to rebroadcast over the internet only, you know, whatever CBS shows you have a week later. And so what CBS is saying is, why would we give that away to Time Warner Cable when we're selling it to Netflix?
Because you can do both, and you're getting $2 per subscriber per month.
Right, precisely.
And you're providing value for what you're doing. It's a big whoop.
Ooh, okay. Well, I think it's kind of a big deal, which actually brings us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story this week could actually have been our lead story, although I guess it happened so long ago. It happened as we were recording last week. So, you might remember when celebrities seemed to be flocking to adopt a little child from, say, you know, Vietnam or Africa, anywhere outside the U.S. Now, the latest charity case seems to be newspapers. Last episode, we reported on the New York Times selling off the Boston Globe to the wealthy owner of the Boston Red Sox, losing the entire $1.1 billion it had spent to buy the outlet. Now we hear that Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, he's the head of it and founder of it, has personally purchased the Washington Post and some related media holdings. It's as if newspapers were lost leaders, like the opera or an art museum. And the only way it can survive is if someone uber-rich, like Michael or myself, some uber-rich individual decides to adopt it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it shows that newspapers are so desperate that the only people that can buy them are billionaires and people who want to just prop them up. Now, everybody says, oh, Jeff Bezos has some plan. He has some goal. He has some scheme. He's too smart. He's going to figure out a way to make, you know, newspapers profitable again. I feel it's more like just he's being nice.
I think you're absolutely right. I think he looked at the, first off, a lot of people have said, hey, you paid too much. It shouldn't have been $250 million. It should have been like half that. Okay, fine, whatever. But I think he looks at what the Washington Post is taking in without all of the legacy debt for pensions and everything, which he did not take on. And he says, look, you know, if you make me $100 million a year, it'll pay for itself, and I get the added bonus of being a great philanthropist. So let's do that. Make me $100 million a year.
And to think how stupid the Times was in buying the Boston Globe. They bought it at the worst point possible for the most money possible, lost over $1 billion. Think of what they could have done with $1 billion. Think how many more employees they could have. Think how much they could expand in the digital realm. Think of all the things they could do with $1 billion.
What an
awful business deal that was.
Just to point out, that $1.1 billion was a price based on the New York Times stock price because it was mostly a stock deal. The stock went down anyway, so they would have lost money. Whether they had bought the Boston Globe or not, they would have been losing some of that money.
But they don't own the stock anymore.
I'm not saying that this was a smart business deal in any
way,
shape, or form.
They don't own the stock anymore. When you give away the stock, you're losing. You could have sold that stock and got $1 billion at that time.
Right.
They could have taken that and invested it in treasury bonds and had the money today. So it doesn't matter whether it was stock or cash. It matters in the sense of how the deal is evaluated, whatever. But no, they gave away $1 billion worth of stock. They could have had an extra $1 billion in cash. And they could have sold off stock, had $1 billion in cash, and used that for the business for the past 20 years. It's a big difference.
Yes. Well, we were just talking about digital rights and everything and this Time Warner Cable dispute. Well, Fox is launching FS1. It's a new 24-hour sports channel that's going mano a mano with ESPN because that's what the world needs, another 24-hour sports network. That's right. And they've, you know, FS1 has just snagged their latest programming coup. FS1 has snared the rights to golf's U.S. Open starting in June of 2015. The 12-year deal reportedly went to Fox because of their thoughtful and intelligent plans for coverage that was both respectable and innovative. Yeah, no, just kidding. They offered a lot more money, reportedly twice as much as NBC, and its sister network, The Golf Channel. Fox reportedly will pay $80 million a year for the 4 days of programming, or $20 million a day. That's up from the $40 million NBC was paying. Adweek says this is a quote-unquote wake-up call for NBC since it doesn't have the rights to any majors and golf. The Golf Channel is losing the top men's and women's amateurs as well. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Big deal. New player, new money. Guess what? Sports rights will continue to accelerate even though they're incredibly, hugely, highly priced right now. And I love how they say it's a wake-up call for NBC and the Golf Channel. You don't have any golf programming. Yeah, it's kind of a wake-up call.
Yeah, you may as well change the name of the channel.
Yes, exactly.
To the No Golf Channel.
Their NBC Sports Channel is called the Hockey Channel because that's the only sports they have the rights to. And hockey's been on hiatus with a strike for a while. And now they have the Golf Channel, which
doesn't
have to be golf.
Hockey isn't on strike anymore.
I know, but it was for a while. It was like, basically, they should have called themselves the Hockey Channel because that was the only thing they had the rights to. And they didn't even have that because they were on strike. So they're like the Nothing Channel. Now they're back to being the Hockey Channel. And the Golf Channel doesn't even have golf.
Okay, well, last week we told you how the South Korean film Snowpiercer had a great debut in its home country, South Korea, of course, and was sure to make its way to the U.S. since the film was mostly in English and included an international cast featuring Jamie Bell, Tilda Swinton, Chris Evans, and more. We talked about it at the head of the show, too. Not so fast, though. The film is being distributed by the Weinsteins, and Harvey Scissorhands is at it again. Though the film got strong reviews, The Hollywood Reporter said it was an epic yet nuanced, contemplative yet entertaining vehicle. Wow, that's a mouthful.
Contemplative.
Contemplative, okay. Well, you know, it's that word, whatever you said.
It's good. It's really good.
Yeah. Harvey wants the director to cut, you know, 20 minutes from the 125-minute film so us folks here in America can understand it. I guess they want to turn what Variety called, quote, an enormously ambitious, visually stunning, and richly satisfying futuristic epic into a shorter futuristic epic. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. God willing, no matter what happens, we'll be able to see the director's cut on DVD, but it's an awful shame. He has, you know, throughout the years proven to have good skills at marketing and selling movies and knowing what will work and cutting movies down and fighting with directors. But he also does have quite a heavy hand. I don't know if I'd ever want to work with him as a director. And this sounds like a really bad idea since it's gotten such great reviews all over the world. It's not like they're describing it as some arty thing. It just feels like they're taking the heart out of it. And it's a shame. But, you know, we'll see it eventually. And that's the blessing of DVD and Blu-ray.
You know, a short aside here, when I was working at Creative Artists Agency, this was, you know, January, I want to say, of 1996, probably. I can't remember the exact date, but Sundance had just ended, and Doug Liman had been signed by Creative Artists Agency, and he was screening his film, Swingers, for a number of people, because I didn't know this at the time. I didn't understand why they were screening it in the screening room there at CAA, but I kind of sat in the back and watched this movie. It was very funny. Of course, Swingers went on to become a classic. And there was John Favreau and Vince Vaughn and Doug Liman, and they watched the film, and then they started talking afterwards. And I wanted to leave the room, but I was like one of the few people in the screening room, and I didn't want to cause a commotion getting up and walking out. And they start talking about, you know, oh, what is the fat man going to want us to cut? Harvey Scissorhands. And they kept saying that. I was like, what are they talking about? Apparently, they wanted him, you know, Doug Liman, to cut a portion of Swingers to make it shorter.
Well, that's, you know, that's often what, you know, the discipline is needed. Directors have, you know, massively long cuts, and you can make it better by tightening it. Cinema Paradiso was famously tightened. You know, it's worked tremendously well commercially, but he's not the most understanding of creative talents.
Yeah, he's been, I guess what I'm saying is, he's been known to ask for this quite often. A New York public radio station that's been a liberal fixture in the media landscape for more than 50 years is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. WBAI-FM just announced it was laying off most of its staff and almost all the voices that listeners are used to hearing over the air. That is, the talent that makes the station unique. It's been losing money since 2004 and was really hit hard by Hurricane Sandy when it had to abandon its Wall Street studios. They're trying to avoid losing their broadcast license completely because they're so far behind on their rent for the transmitter they use. WBAI is a nonprofit, unfortunately. They've taken that too much to heart. It's one of the five stations owned by Pacifica, which also owns stations in LA and DC. The New York station has launched popular shows, including the widely syndicated news show Democracy Now. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. The one in D.C. is also, they may go under by this September. So, you know, we're talking 6 weeks, they may go under. They only own five stations, so two of them may go under. And they said, well, we're restructuring our finances and maybe we'll be able to last long term. Well, without two-fifths of the stations you have right now. Democracy Now! Is a big public radio program all over the country. I'd never heard of it till I moved to Illinois and did my radio show. They used to have Democracy Now! As part of the mix in their daytime programming. It's sort of like, you know, All Things Considered, but really liberal. You think NPR is liberal, baby, you don't know nothing till you've heard Democracy Now! It's like an alternate universe of media coverage, but it's very good reporting. It's a very good show. And, you know, it's depressing. The biggest thing here is that newspapers are disappearing and radio is disappearing. And those are the people that are watchdogs on local government. They're the people watching the cops, the schools, the governor, the mayor, these people. And that whole infrastructure that we depend on in ways we don't even think about. Somebody actually goes to school board meetings. Somebody actually goes to city hall meetings. Somebody actually goes to the board meetings and sees what's happening and pays attention and writes and talks about it. And that's disappearing all over the country. And that's going to have really big effects long term.
In lieu, by the way, of giant corporations. So Rollerball is really coming true.
That's true.
I'm sure it has nothing to do with the lawsuit, so maybe it's a funny coincidence, but ABC is being sued by a group in Nashville, Tennessee for refusing to cast minorities as The Bachelor or The Bachelorette in the reality dating series. And now they've just announced the newest Bachelor, and he just happens to be the first non-Caucasian in the show's history. Juan Pablo Galavis. Is that, how do you pronounce that?
You can just call him Juan Pablo.
Juan Pablo. He is the newest Bachelor. The former Venezuelan soccer player and single father of a little girl competed for the heart of teary rebound queen Desiree in the season, this season, I guess, of The Bachelorette. That just ended. Now he'll be looking for love on his own when the show returns in January. I'm tempted to ask whether this is a big deal or a big whoop, but can we just move on?
This is a big whoop overall, but it's also a pretty lame. This is about the safest Caucasianist non-Caucasian you come up with. Juan Pablo does have an accent, but if you look at him, you don't even realize that he's not white. I mean, he's a very nice guy. He's appealing. I watched a couple clips to see what he was like online. But when I mentioned, my sister said, oh, hey, they've got their first non-Caucasian bachelor. She said, who is this? It's Juan Pablo. She says, well, barely. I mean, basically, you know, he lives in Miami. He's got a lovely accent. But if you looked at a picture, you'd have no idea that this was the first non-Caucasian bachelor. Not exactly a brother is what I'm saying. So, you know, they did it, but it's very timid toe in the water. It isn't exactly like he's, you know, Latin Brazilian, or, you know, he doesn't look very non-Caucasian. So
what you're saying is he doesn't say things like, I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I drink Dos Equis.
No, he's got an accent. He's got an accent, no question about it. But his appearance and such is not exactly groundbreaking. So they did it, but it's a pretty timid step forward.
Are you just learning to love your Blu-ray discs when streaming just won't cut it? Well, don't get too attached. Sony and Panasonic are developing the next generation of optical discs to debut in 2015. Blu-rays contain 50 gigabytes of information. The new discs will contain 300 gigabytes. The discs are really geared towards professional archiving, but prices will fall and the discs will surely migrate to the general public. With studios pushing digital downloads and streaming services like Netflix, will anyone even care? Well, thanks to 4K and 8K movie standards in the pipeline for TV screens and feature films, not to mention higher frame rates, these discs might just become essential to show the movies at home without downgrading the image. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big opportunity.
What? Wait, that was not one of the choices.
You can have an entire TV series on one disc, cheaply, and yes, it could be backwards compatible so that, you know, this player obviously should be able to play all Blu-rays and DVDs. With streaming and downloads, the trend, and every single movie that gets released on DVD, they put it out on streaming like a week or a month earlier. They really want you to buy the digital download. But these discs could be a very cheap alternative, as long as they don't think it's an expensive new upgrade. As long as, unlike Blu-ray, they don't say, hey, we can charge more money. As long as they realize, hey, this is a great way to entice consumers to make all our library available in a really simple, easy way. You can have an entire series on one disc or two discs, you know, four seasons, five seasons of a sitcom. As long as they use this as a way to make physical storage of movies and TV shows really appealing and cheap, they could keep this going, which is what they want to do because they've got the digital download. But if you can make a little extra money doing this, you should. And when you look at movies that are in 4K and 8K, guess what? They need like 100 gigabytes of storage.
Minimum.
So you're going to need them just to show a single movie in the new standards that are coming along. And why give up physical sales if you don't have to?
I couldn't agree more. Now, CNN hasn't even shot a single frame yet, but its proposed documentary about Hillary Clinton prompted the Republican National Committee to threaten the media outlet. If CNN went through with making and releasing a documentary film about Clinton, it would refuse to participate in any presidential debates leading up to the next election. CNN wasn't alone. NBC received the same threat for announcing a miniseries about the potential first lady turned Madam President. CNN slapped back that maybe the RNC should wait until the documentary is actually made before prejudging it. To which the RNC said, but wait, that's what critics do for the Lone Ranger. No, never mind. But the progressive watchdog group Media Matters isn't waiting. They say the RNC is right and that the proposed miniseries and documentary coming amidst a likely presidential run for Clinton are rife with conflicts of interest and poor timing. Founder David Brock is worried that the news divisions will be tainted by these entertainments and that the networks might bow to right-wing demands. They include what Brock calls fake scandals like Travelgate, which, God, that was so long ago, 1992, 93, yikes. And just to confuse things further, Fox may become the international distributor for the film, which will star Diane Lane as Clinton. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I think they'd be asinine to avoid the coverage of a major network's debate, even though they want to cut back on debates. You know, why are you going to give a primetime slot for your candidates? It's ridiculous. It's a stupid threat. I also think making it a 2 or 4 hour miniseries or 6 hour miniseries about Hillary Clinton is a really stupid idea commercially. You know, it's going to be awful. doing a miniseries about Hillary Clinton at this stage is just, ugh, I don't want to see it. It's going to be horrible. Either it'll be too fawning or it'll just be sleazy and stupid, or who knows, it'll be too respectful. It's not the right time to do it. She's running for president.
Well,
she
has
a good point.
Well, she has not said that she's doing that yet.
She's running for president. She most certainly is running for president. Don't tell me she's not running for president. She's running for president.
Well,
trust me, she's running for president. Everybody knows she's running for president. Don't tell us you're not sure because she hasn't said so officially. She's running for president. Joe Biden's running for president. My mother's running for president. It's happening. But it's a really bad idea creatively. A miniseries about
Hillary. What about a documentary?
Right now. The documentary was meant for theatrical release, not even to be aired on CNN. Like, a news organization is not supposed to make a news documentary about a major candidate for president? Really?
Yeah.
Like, why is that off limits? You know, should it be a good documentary? Yes. Should it be balanced and smart and investigative? And of course. But
no, the Republicans only like slanted documentaries like Obama 2016 or whatever. Obama's
right, right. American. They released their own documentary about Hillary in the last election. And they released a 4-hour film and they paid money to have it air on television, like, you know, months before one of the primaries. So, you know, give me a break.
Director Ken Loach has made about 30 feature films in his career, including critical acclaim for everything from his breakthrough Kes in 1969 to Lady Bird, Lady Bird in 1994 to the top prize at Cannes for the Wind That Shakes the Barley in 2006. Wow.
Love that film.
That seems like it was just yesterday and it was,
yeah.
His latest is fairly typical, called Jimmy's Hall. It's about an Irish communist leader who returns home in 1932 after a decade in America to reopen the music hall he founded years earlier. His latest will also likely be his last. The 77-year-old director has already begun filming the elaborate period piece, and while he has a few ideas for documentaries to make, this film will likely be Loach's last feature. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in a way. He's 77. So, I mean, clearly you're coming to the end of your career unless you're Manuel de Oliveras, who makes films and he's 99 years old. For most people, it's about the end. But obviously he's a very interesting director. He's made a lot of really good movies for decades now. So it's sad to see it come to an end, but you'd love to see him end on top. John Huston's last film as director was The Dead, one of his greatest films. So if Ken Loach can end with Jimmy's Hall and it's a great movie, that's a great way to go out. Peter Sellers, his second to last film was Being There, a masterpiece. He almost won the Oscar. His last film that Peter Sellers made as an actor was like The Many Faces of Fu Manchu. Horrible movie. So being able to end on top is a really good thing. So I'm not going to be sad about it. I'm going to be glad.
Well, I happen to really like Ken Loach's, at least most of Ken Loach's films, and particularly, the ones in his later career here. They're written by Paul Laverty, and The Angel Share, I think, was the last one. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that film. Then there was the one about the soccer.
Yeah.
Searching for Eric or something.
That was very funny.
Yeah, they're great films, and for some reason, they never get any traction here in the U.S., Okay, well, I guess that's...
I agree.
Alrighty then. Spoiler alert, the Finding Nemo sequel will not have a sad ending. Nope. But exactly what kind of ending will it have? The movie, which stars the voices of Ellen DeGeneres and Albert Brooks, was going to climax at a SeaWorld-type location. But the documentary film Blackfish, which actually premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and I saw it there, has given them second thoughts. The movie depicts what it calls horrific conditions for killer whales. Now the Pixar film will apparently end at the park, but let characters choose whether they want to stay there or not. The creatives reportedly said they were worried the film would later look like their quote-unquote Songs of the South, which I don't know why I said quote-unquote. That's the title of a movie, Song of the South. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. And it's like, okay, they've decided that they're worried that these places will look horrific. So they're going to let the fish decide, hey, do you want to stay in a place that will drive you insane and kill yourself? It's like, either get it out or, don't be wimpy about it. But whatever, it's just stupid. And comparing it to slavery is offensive. Song of the South is about happy, happy slaves working for the white man. And, comparing this film about animated fish and whether they end up in an aquarium or not is ridiculous and overbearing. And frankly, Song of the South should be released on Blu-ray. Release it, put it in proper context. There's some great animation, some great stories, and great things in there. 90% of the movie is not offensive at all. It's just the animated segments. You've got the wraparound sections, which can be put into context, and people could choose to watch just the animated stories themselves and enjoy them perfectly well. So the fact that you can't see Song of the South is very annoying to me.
I couldn't agree more on that. Blackfish, by the way, well worth seeing. It's an interesting movie about really how Shamu and killer whales, I mean, it's when you actually learn about how this they're treated, how they're captured, how they're kept in captivity.
Much of which would be challenged, of course, by SeaWorld and the people there.
Yes. You very quickly go, yeah, I'm not going to go to SeaWorld
again. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty definitive. You know, it's not like, you know, it's like, hey, you know, in the wild, they live to 100 and at SeaWorld, they live to 35. So in any case, like AMC's Mad Men, the drama Breaking Bad has been more of a critic's darling than, say, a ratings blockbuster. That hasn't really changed yet, but it's notable how binge viewing and the constant availability of the show in various forms has propelled the final season opener to a huge jump in ratings. The show leaped from, say, 2.9 million viewers for the first episode of last season to a record 5.9 million viewers of the first of 8 final episodes.
They doubled their viewing. Wow.
Yes, yes. That does not include the DVR numbers for plus 3 or plus 7, so live plus 3 days, live plus 7 days. So the actual audience is sure to be much bigger. Plus, 3.6 million of those initial viewers were in the 18 to 49 demo that advertisers wrongly prize the most. It's a credit to Breaking Bad, but also a big credit to DVRs, TV marathons, DVD box sets, on-demand, and streaming services. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's great to see this show. It's one of the best shows on television, perhaps, of all time. I hope they end it well. It's gotten a little ugly right towards the end. So I hope they pull it through and keep the complexity and humanity of the character as they turn him into a horrible monster. But doubling your audience for the last season is amazing. That's a huge jump. But still, it's 6 million people. So that's in the context of a network show. That's a hell of a lot better than they were doing. But it's not exactly Walking Dead numbers. But still, it's a great, great credit to the show. It's coming into a final stretch and people are really paying attention. And clearly, a lot of people have caught up in the past via all these other venues. And that's why a show in its fifth year is growing, which never happened before. Rarely, rarely, rarely did a show grow a lot 5 years in.
This next story makes me want to say, you provide the prose poems and I'll provide the war. Yes, and if you get that reference, then you are a film aficionado. Orson Welles, he continues to surprise even years after his death. Everyone knows his first film was The Extraordinary Citizen Kane, from which the line I just said comes from. It's one of the all-time greats. And it was his motion picture debut, by the way. However, it turns out Welles also shot about 40 minutes of film meant to be shown as part of a Broadway revival involving his Mercury Theater actors, including Joseph Cotten. The most intriguing section is a silent film chase through Lower Manhattan. Welles ran around the city playing with his new toy and capturing Manhattan in 1938. The footage amounted to roughly 40 minutes in all and was believed destroyed. However, it resurfaced this year, is being restored for a festival screening, and will probably be made available online for free within the next year. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. I can't wait to see it. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. But, you know, it's not the final rule of the Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, that would be amazing.
That would be really exciting. Or, you know, The Other Side of the Wind, a film which he basically completed, not all the editing, but it's there and it's just tangled up in legal rights. Peter Bogdanovich has worked on it. John Huston, who I mentioned a little bit ago, stars as a film director in that movie. And that's a complete film waiting to be seen that is there. And that it needs to be edited to a degree. But, you know, it's an Orson Welles entire film. This is like a short stuff done for as part of a Broadway show that they were doing. And it sounds like it's going to be really cool and seeing a director with an early days playing with a camera. But I don't think it'll rock our world the way The Last Reel of the Ambersons or that entire film, The Other Side of the Wind, will do. However, if you come to our website, follow the link to the YouTube thing we have. That's Orson Welles at the end of his career doing a voiceover for a TV commercial where he starts to rip into the director and rip into the people who read the copy. He was not a happy man to work with in the end of his days.
No, he was kind of a grouch.
It's a very, very funny thing to listen to. So if you're a Welles fan at all, you've probably seen it already. But if not, check it out and go, oi, I wouldn't want to have to work with that man.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe he was saying, you know, we will show no film before it's time.
Exactly.
Didn't he? He did that.
Yep.
Yeah. And if you get that, then you are a big fan of advertising.
And wine.
That's true. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, which is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we kind of have two stories, which we'll go over quickly here. You might recall last week, George Clooney handed somebody there his, you know, kind of ripped somebody a new one. And that somebody was Daniel Loeb. And Daniel Loeb is a self-proclaimed activist investor. He heads up the hedge fund Third Point. And Third Point owns now about 7% of Sony stock and has been pushing to have Sony, the electronics manufacturer, spin off its entertainment division. So motion pictures.
Because it's so poorly run.
Because it's so poorly run and it's just a shambles, and Sony would be worth more if... Now, he did this with Yahoo, okay? And he kind of became an activist investor at Yahoo and tried to get on the board. And he didn't succeed there, but he did succeed in getting Yahoo to replace the CEO.
And did he make money?
And he did make money.
Well, that's all that matters.
Now, this time... He's succeeding, but not... No, he's not even succeeding here, because Sony's turned around and said, no, we're not going to spin off our entertainment divisions. Thank you very much.
But he spinned it off by saying, oh, they sent me a letter and it was really thoughtfully written.
Right.
It was very smart. I really appreciate that. There's a lot to think about. And then he said, George Clooney, he said lots of great things. You know, we've got a lot more in common than he realizes. So he's like, not only is he's like insulting him again. George is too dumb to realize I agree with him about thoughtful, intelligent filmmaking. It's just that I was blasting the studio for all the intelligent, thoughtful films that they made.
Right. You know, I believe our interests are aligned in a way he probably doesn't realize. For instance, we both want Sony to do well. However, Sony, he started buying stock in January of 2013, this year.
And it was about $9 at that time.
Yeah, it was like $11 or $9, somewhere in there. Yeah, it was.
Well, that's a big difference, but yeah, it was about $10, and now it's at $20.19. So he's doubled whatever he spent. If he bought it all at that time, which he didn't, you know, the stock has doubled since he started investing in it. He made it clear to the public that he had this stake in Sony. That was about in mid-May, right?
Yeah, so it started out at $11.51 on January 2nd. In mid-May, it was up, and he kind of made it known in like May 13th, somewhere around there. At that point, the stock leapt to $22.91.
Right. And now it's come back down to 20 bucks. So since he's been public and agitating and pushing and yelling and screaming, Sony stock has remained around $18 or $20. It's at $20 now. It's up a bit, about 10% from when he made public his investment and his problems with Sony and what they should do. So it has ticked up a bit, so he can claim or pretend to claim, oh, look, I made a lot of noise and now the stock is higher. But of course, what he was saying was get rid of the entertainment division, and then that's not happening.
Right. And, you know, he tries, in my opinion, he goes into what he believes are troubled companies and tries to make some type of waves. It barely worked with Yahoo. I don't think he got a seat on the board. He was able to get Marissa Meyer in there, so that kind of worked, and the stock rose. Here, I look at it and say, look, the stock was on the rise long before you announced that you were a part of this, because back in May, you had it, it was at $17.20 already before he said anything.
Why did the stock rise so much this year?
I don't know. I have no idea. Earnings, probably. It was probably undervalued.
And this is why our portfolios suck.
Right. It's why I don't invest in the stock market.
All right. Well, let's move on.
Okay. So basically, Sony said to Daniel Loeb, no, thank you. Bye. And Daniel Loeb said, well, I'm going to be watching. Always watching. And you know what movie that's from, right?
And no.
Always watching.
Still no.
Monsters, Inc.
Oh, no, I only saw it once and I didn't like it.
Okay, well, our next story here is, you might recall way back in, I don't know when, maybe February, we talked about how Fullscreen Media and Maker Studios cut a deal with Universal Music to like allow their video uploaders, members of their multi-channel networks on YouTube, to cover their songs. Well, you know, all these MCNs, be it Maker Studios or... In this case, Fullscreen.
None of which I've heard of. And I've never heard that term.
Yeah,
I mean, I know we've used it on the show, but it means nothing to me.
Well, Fullscreen Media is now being sued. That's basically where we're headed with this. And they're being sued by Warner Chappell because they didn't cut a deal with Warner Chappell. And some of the people who make content for Fullscreen Media, which then goes on to YouTube, well, they cover songs that are published by Warner Chappell. And Warner Chappell is saying, hey, you owe us some money for that. You should be licensing this stuff.
So last week, we found out that online radio stations and things like Yahoo Music and people who turn to this service, one of these companies that claims that they can license millions of songs.
MediaNet,
they turn to them to get a blanket license. Turns out they didn't really have the ability to license them. Now we find out other people don't even bother to get a blanket license, and they're still posting videos with songs on them that they don't have the rights to and making a lot of money off it.
Right. Now, multi-channel networks.
Is the internet just the Wild West? Why aren't people doing the hard work that needs to be done before they go public with their business?
Because it's really hard.
And they want to make money.
Right. And multi-channel networks, you ask what they are. They basically are content aggregators. They are some of the most popular channels, if you will, on YouTube. They provide some of the most popular videos on
the service.
But nobody
says, oh, I'm going to go watch full screen, do they? No one says, I want to watch a Vimeo. They just go to YouTube. They just go and find the video they're looking for.
Yeah,
they don't say, I really want to watch Vimeo.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Right. No teenager goes, oh, let's check out full screen.
Yeah, I don't think... yeah.
Are they more back room?
I think they're front room and more back room because they basically aggregate all this content. So on that level, they're back room, they're front room in terms of, you know, when you go to one of the channels or one of their little, I don't know what you'd call them, one of their content providers, it says, you know, a full screen channel or a full screen content.
Right. Yeah, nobody pays attention. So what's going to happen and why do we care?
Well, what's going to happen, you know, some are criticizing or pointing out that Full Screen was probably trying to negotiate a licensing deal with Warner Chappelle, and it just didn't work out. So Warner Chappelle turned around and sued to get all the royalties and damages and everything because Warner Chappelle, a music publisher,
without a license.
Yeah, more right. Warner Chappelle cut a similar deal with Maker Studios just last week. So the negotiations probably broke down, and they'll probably find a way to reach an agreement now.
And settle before they go to court.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And then that means teenagers can still run around singing their version of Blurred Lines and be happy.
Correct.
All right.
But you know what you can do, Michael?
What?
You could get everyone you know and everyone all the people that your friends know to subscribe to our podcast.
Okay. How do they do it?
Well, they can subscribe on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give out podcast for free. And I've been told that the Zune Marketplace is now called the Microsoft Marketplace.
Well, then that's what you should call it.
Yes. So anywhere they give out podcasts for free, podcast aggregators instead of multi-channel networks, hey, subscribe to our show, rate and review our show. That would really help us out. You can also follow us. We have a Twitter account. It's at Showbiz Sandbox. So on Twitter, search for us. On Facebook, look us up and like our page. It can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to follow us and subscribe to us and even ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. This week, let's see, where are they? They can be found in Monterey, California on August 24th. And on August 25th, they'll be right here in Los Angeles, California to perform live for...
Are they staying at your house, Sperling?
No, they're not.
Okay.
No, unfortunately. But now, Michael, you have a website. I know you run bookfilter.com, but you also have a website where some of your work can be found, some of your more journalistic work. Where is that website? Where can we find it?
It's at I Hope Neil Young Will Remember, A Southern Man Don't Need Him Around Anyhow.com.
You know, the shorter version of that is michaelgiltz.com. So if you can't remember...
Sweet Home Alabama. See, I didn't pay for that, did I? Uh-oh, fair use. I better stop there.
Now, next week, the week of August 18th, we will not be having a show. It's the end of summer.
And... Oh, Sperling, it's your fault.
Yes, it's pretty... Well, wait a second. I'm just saying there's not a lot to cover. That's all I'm saying. So remember, August 25th is our next show. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com in the meantime. So until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
Sweet Home Alabama.
What are you going to sing when you're in Nashville?
Anything by Patsy Cline.
Okay. Just make sure you get the license for that.